Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Thank you for being with us here. I'm Rick Moore. Our topic today, something a little different. We're going to be talking about depression and mental health. Our guest today, Dr. Lewis Weber. Good morning.
Good morning.
And Mr. George Enfield. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Dr. Weber, licensed clinical social worker who's been working in the mental health field since 1969. He's held faculty positions at the UVA Psychiatry and Clinical Psychology Departments and at UVA Counseling Center. He also specializes in loss and grief, separation, divorce, and death. Mr. George Enfield is a licensed professional counselor who's been working in mental health since 1993. During this time, he's focused extensively on the treatment of children. Experiences include providing debriefing to first responders in the Oklahoma City bombing and been a part of comprehensive assessment team for the treatment of young children. And he's a registered play therapist supervisor. So good morning and thank you for being with us today. For I would think that this is a difficult topic for people to discuss outside of going to a therapist, because I would think that it's a difficult decision to make to even go to a therapist. It seems like for many people that this is a stigma.
Yeah.
I mean, would you agree or disagree with that?
Actually, you know, it ranges. To tell you the truth, for some people, it's a real relief. You'd be surprised how many people are relieved to hear that they're depressed and have an explanation so they know what they're dealing with, or to feel relief to be able to talk to friends about it. You're right, some people feel ashamed of it. Some people shy away from it because it feels so overwhelming. But then there's another group that are just grateful to have a chance to talk about it and really express things. And unfortunately, sometimes people stay away from asking loved ones or friends about it, thinking they're protecting them when they're really not being supportive to them.
I went to, you know, just on my own, I thought, you know, I think just looking up, trying to find a description of depression, and I kept coming up with the word stigma. So I thought, oh, well, let's find a good metaphor for that. So it's a modern day what? So let's go back and find what was an old time stigma. And everything was mental health. All the stigmas, you go back to Middle Ages, everything was mental health problems. I could not find an old-timey stigma that wasn't. Now, I'm sure somebody, if they wanted to call in, or I mean, you know, maybe the two of you could throw one out at me. But mental health issues, depression, go back hundreds of years as being something to be embarrassed about. But here we are today to talk about it because it's not something to be embarrassed about. It's something that you go out to seek, and the word you used, Dr. Weber, was relief for. There are professionals out there to offer help and relief.
Correct.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, actually you can go back to the beginning of time for man. And at one point they were burning people as witches just to So mental health was always a concern, and there has been a history of shame and embarrassment and not mentioning family members who may have emotional problems or kind of shunning them. That does exist, certainly.
I'm curious, at what point, how do you find the difference between, you know, sadness and the blues versus depression? You know, if you're in the family, if you're a friend, and you have someone, whether of whatever age, and you can't tell, you know, let's just start with the simple definition.
Well, it's all on a continuum, so it's not just a simple breaking point that this is this and this is that. Well, with sadness versus depression, let's say it vacillates between degree, the intensity of it, how long it's progressed and lasted. Has there been trigger things recently that would be normal sadness? I know George, for instance, works with a lot of postpartum women, and they talk about the blues, whereas there's a whole continuum where it's not any longer just a simple blues of getting over a birth, or maybe a problematic birth, but it goes further up in the continuum. So it's if you think of it on a continuum with heightened symptoms, prolonged symptoms, then you're thinking about depression.
Children and adults are a little bit different. With kids, when you think about depression, sometimes it shows up more as behavior rather than actually like the blues where you mope around. It does sometimes show up as the moping, but a lot of times it shows up as anger, temper tantrums, a difficulty sitting still. So it's a different type of continuum. It's working with and then recognizing what does the person need or what is the child trying to tell us. That's how we figure out what's happening.
Yeah, George makes an important point about symptomology. For instance, a lot of time in men it comes out with irritability, easy anger, not just men, but that's typically referred to as men, but short temper. You may see kids and adults acting out, whether it's doing illegal things or it's drugs or alcohol. Those sometimes can be masked for an expression of depression.
So, again, we are talking about depression. We're talking about mental health. Our guest today, Mr. George Enfield, Dr. Lewis Weber. I'm curious what got the two of you interested in this field?
Well, that's an interesting question. Part of it was just the luck of the roll. I was very fortunate to just get into a graduate program that really suited me. And certainly unbeknownst to me at that time was the quest for my own solutions to my own mental illness, my own family stuff, just like a lot of the people in the field. It's also a very rewarding field to be in. You know, I mean, how rare is it for you to be able to sit with someone who is willing to be very intimate with you and share all kinds of things and trust that you'll be respectful of that and also that you have something to offer them in their process of hopefully healing?
My path was a little bit different. I liked kids, and so it was how do you figure out how to engage, and being able to see things that I didn't feel like kids were being heard when they were spoken to. So because we listen to the words and we don't always listen to the behavior, and so the behaviors tell us more about what's going on than the words sometimes do. And so sometimes watching the kids do things and being able to translate that for families ends up being really powerful and really rewarding when you can actually say to someone, hey, this is how your child's trying to communicate with you. So it's a little bit different path.
The other piece of it for me is I've seen people get better, and that's been an incentive to stay in the field and a motivation to be in the field.
Can people be cured of depression, or is it just, I mean, when you talk about depression, is depression a disease like, I mean, it's not a broken arm, right? A broken arm can be fixed. You put a cast on it, and the arm is no longer broken. Okay? With depression, whether it's medicine, or conversation, or both, can depression be cured, or just, what's the other phrase that I want, where it's put further down the line, or I put this here in my notes, where it's just put aside.
So I see two points in what you're bringing up. One of them is the analogy that you made of a broken arm. Broken arms and things like that are really interesting because you can see them. They're external. So a broken arm, you wear a cast. Or if blindness, you have a cane. Those kinds of things, if you're in a wheelchair, you are in a wheelchair. If you're incapacitated. Depression is one of those things that you can't see. It's invisible. It's inside. And so when we talk about a cure, is it something that can be cured? That's pretty individual. So you may say, after doing talk therapy or medication or something of those natures, I'm cured. I don't feel depressed any longer. But another person who has the same symptoms, may have had the same life experiences that led to the depression, may not feel cured. And it's not because that they're not, it's just we change the way in which we perceive things. And so it's about perception. So understanding our own perception about ourselves and how we perceive the depression. Is the depression something that's more powerful and imposes itself in my daily routine? Or is it something that I can manage and work with? Then it changes the nature of it. So we go from different levels. And we all have days when we are blue, when we're bad, when we feel bad. But are we having more of those days or fewer of those days? And so there's two different elements that are involved that I see. One of them is the kind of outward part where everybody sees the blues. And then there's the personal part, the inside part, that nobody else knows except you and the person that you're working with. So I think it's workable. And in some cases, it does go away. Bereavement, you always feel the loss. It doesn't, you know, if you lose somebody that you care about and you love, they're not going to go away. But does that hurt cause you to sit on the couch every night and cry about it for months? Or are you able to get out and have a good time and laugh again? If that's your definition of cured, then yes. Does that make sense?
It does. And again, I'm going to make foolish statements throughout the hour because all I'm doing is learning through this hour. And that's one of the reasons I like to have these sorts of shows on the wake-up call is to have people who know about the topic who can come in and teach me. But unfortunately, I publicly make an ass of myself during the time period. But in some ways, I have thoughts of depression sort of like alcoholism, which is, can you cure depression, or is it just sort of set aside until it strikes again?
Well, George is making some good points about it being individualized. There are different kinds of depression. Some people do need to maintain, like, medication. The bipolar folks that have bipolar depression, for example. Some people have been so traumatized in their early life that depression will continue in some degree, but they can maintain themselves and even improve. And interestingly enough, there are some people that feel that the rewards of ongoing therapy are so helpful they'll continue for long term, not just because they're so depressed, but because they see themselves having an opportunity to grow and learn and experience things that will help them be even better in relationships with themselves and others. So there's no simple answer to it.
Why is there never a simple answer to a difficult topic?
Because people are complicated.
Our guests today, George Enfield and Dr. Lewis Weber, as we talk about depression and mental health. One of the things that you seem to find are people who always have advice for those with depression. Correct? It's always, well, if you only do this, won't you feel better? If you get outside more, if you, you know, I always, well, every time I go running, I feel better. When I stopped eating sugar, I felt better all the time. Things like that.
Well, you know, there are things you can do to improve, but when you talk about advice, I do a lot of group therapy, and I had a sign at one point, I don't anymore, that says advice is cheap. In other words, you can go to the bus stop, you can go to the hair shop, you can go to the bar, and people will be glad to tell you what to do. Sometimes advice can be helpful, but sometimes it's someone really cutting you off, and what's most important is people listening and understanding what you're trying to tell them. I think that's the most helpful piece. Now, there are things we can do. Certainly, you mentioned exercising is very helpful. Nutrition, a good diet is very helpful. Going to your physician and making sure you have thorough physicals to make sure there's not something like a thyroid problem or other things that are happening or complications with medications for medical issues. Those are important things that you can do to be helpful in this process.
But what do you do if you are someone who's been diagnosed with depression? What do you do when you are around people, whether it's one person or many people, who are giving you this cheap advice, which is you're not finding helpful, but maybe only finding more hurtful?
Well, you made a good point about hurtful. A lot of people feel shunned or more ashamed or feel angry that their spouse won't listen to them. Rather than, you know, it's a frequent thing about women talking about their husband, if you just listen, I don't need you to fix it, because it really shuts them down. So you just hope that people, you can find some people that can understand that. A lot of reasons for depression is being raised in families where you weren't heard. You know, George was mentioning trying to find ways to hear children, what they're saying. And raising family, feeling heard, feeling seen is akin to feeling loved. And when you don't have that, it's very hurtful. It hurts your self-esteem. It hurts your sense of worth. And part of the rewards of being in therapy, or I'm mentioning group therapy, is people that are hearing you, understanding you, and relating to you. Rather than say, fix it, here's what you need to do. What's the matter with you? If you could only do A, B, and C, then you'd be fine. That just doesn't work, unfortunately.
George, is that the same for children? I mean, at some point, and I don't know what age children are you working with.
I started two.
Until what point?
Until, well, I have some adult clients as well. But you do play therapy predominantly with ages 2 to 14.
And so if you've got 14-year-olds, mm-hmm. at what point are they able to say, that's hurtful? You know, giving me advice is not listening.
Right, well, they do. They just don't use those words. So kids say things are hurtful, but they don't use the language. That's why we watch the behavior. So a child may say something's hurtful by throwing toys across the room, or dumping cabinets, or not listening, or running away. They say that's hurtful by the physiological or the physical response, not by the words, because they may not have the words. They may not recognize the words. Part of the work that we do, or that I do, and the folks that work with children, is, remember, we don't come into this world knowing the words depression. We don't come into this world knowing happy, mad, sad, scared. We learn those as we grow up. We don't come out talking. So it's not until children are about 4 or 5 years old, in many cases, that they actually start to recognize feelings. If you reference things like Inside Out, Riley, the little girl that you're inside her head, is 11 years old. And she's just now learning the difference between the five feelings that she had and the blending of those feelings. So depression is just one, sadness. So they play it out, or they act it out, rather than say it. The hard part is when you're talking to peers, children's peers, they don't always recognize that someone's saying you're being hurtful. They see it as you're being mean. And that's part of where the stigma comes in.
Actually, even, and George has taught me this, interventions even start with newborns. That's more around helping with the mother and the parents deal with things. We even have a group at our practice that are new moms. I mean, so there are all kinds of interventions you make. A lot of work with parents. I know George does a lot of work with parents, for example. Very young, young kids. That's very helpful, too.
Depression and mental health with Dr. Lewis Weber and Mr. George Enfield. We'll be right back. And here we are back, 94.7 Sunday morning wake-up call. Thank you for tuning in today on a Sunday morning. Our guests, Dr. Lewis Weber and Mr. George Enfield, as we talk about depression. George, you specialize in kids, and we've touched on that briefly. So you talk about how kids sometimes, you know, they don't use words or don't use the same words. So you were watching them through actions. Registered play therapist supervisor. Right. So I'm curious as to how that works with, I mean, the basic topic of the show is depression. So for a lot of people, a lot of listeners today, how does a 10-year-old become depressed? And then how do you use registered play therapy to do something about it?
So play therapy in general is expressive interactions. It's expressive therapy. So it's things like art and clay and sand and toys. So if you think about the first part of your question, which was talking about how does a 10-year-old become depressed, the same way a lot of people become depressed. They are worried about stresses at school. They feel like they're unsuccessful. They feel like they're not succeeding in school, either by grades being too low or parental pressures. You know, mom and dad are saying you need to do better on your grades. Those are lots of avenues. Could be loss. Family loss, could be transitions, and could be other traumas. So we all reach depression in a very similar path in the sense that they're challenges. How do we help kids with that? It's kind of a multi-pronged approach, because part of it is, one, helping the child label it and understand what it is. And the second part of it is helping them learn to manage it and explore it and talk about it themselves, either in art form or play of some type, either with toys or with sand, or, as I said. And then another approach is actually to help the parents understand that their child's depressed, and help them see the words for, oh, my kid's feeling overwhelmed and there's too much going on in their world. I'm putting too much pressure on them. Or they've lost something, and we need to explore that loss a little bit more.
That seems like that may be the more difficult part of the equation.
Talking with parents?
getting the parent to believe that their child may be depressed. I just have this image in my head of a stereotypical parent not wanting to believe that their child is flawed.
Right, and that's not how we approach it.
May not be how you approach it,
mm-hmm.
but it may be how a parent would begin to believe it.
That's how they might interpret it, and so that's part of what the therapy is about. It's about recognizing that this isn't about a character defect or something that's wrong with their child. It's the way that their child is seeing and experiencing things. And so we try and shift that thinking. And as Lou or Dr. Weber said earlier, a lot of it has to do with educating folks and honoring them for where they are. And so we say, hey, this is what's happening. Let's look at what's going on. And how do we address those concerns more directly rather than walk around them? Remember, the reason people get in or we actually start working with kids is because their parents are confused. My child's acting out. My child's sitting in a corner and not engaging or not playing, and I'm sitting there watching them on the sidelines not doing anything. So what's that about? And they're not understanding. So they're coming to us for understanding.
So and I've put that stigma on it. When I said...
Yeah, that would be a description of the stigma, yeah.
Yeah, when I said flaw.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's also another aspect of it. Sometimes parents don't see it because they're depressed and they don't see their own. So they can't adjust the child having any difficulties. In fact, sometimes the desired treatment may be for the parents to get in therapy, or the mother or the father, as opposed to the child. The child is just representing what's going on in the family. So
kids are pretty good at, if a parent can't talk about what's going on, they'll do it for them. So sometimes when a kid's coming in depressed, it's just they're mirroring what's happening or they're acting out because the parent can't. At which point then we would refer. I would refer to someone that does adult work.
Again, our guest today, George Enfield, Dr. Louis Weber, as we talk about mental health and depression, I'd like to know if are we better at identifying depression than we were 20, 40, 60 years ago? Or is it just a greater percentage of our population that has depression?
I think we're greater at seeing it. I don't think it's a greater numbers. I mean, the numbers are astonishingly high, relatively speaking. You know, at any given year, you've got 6% of the you've got 6% of the folks in our country with depression, post 6% of significant depression. Used to be, you'd kind of lock the person away, you'd ignore them. There weren't all the mental health professionals there are. Physicians and ministers are much more key to the idea of mental illness. It's more acceptable. You don't have to pretend that Aunt Betty went to the hospital and kind of ignoring that she's there. People aren't staying in hospitals as long as they used to. There are new medications, new forms of treatment. And it's more popularly talked about. Even the fact you're having this on this phone, on this radio show today speaks to that. And all the popularized articles and things that talk about depression, all the important celebrities and others that admit they have depression or anxiety or eating disorders or things like that.
I think with children, it's also the treatment of children is really young when you think about it.
Well, you mentioned 2 years old.
Right, but if the age of the child is young, very rarely do you have a depressed 2-year-old. Frequently, you have a depressed parent who's not reading their child's cues right, or not right. They're not accurately reading them. But when we think about the field of mental health relative to other things, working with children is relatively young. It was in the 60s was when that started, and Freud was much younger than that. You know, was much older than that. So working with adults and working with children, we don't have the same base. So I would say we're getting much, much more accurate dealing with kids as we have more experience and more trained professionals looking at these issues.
Again, our guest today, George Enfield, Dr. Lewis Weber, as we talk about mental health and depression. Thank you for listening on Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. This is 94.7 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Gentlemen, medications versus conversations for treatment are... there is no stereotype, correct, for someone with depression? I mean, you can watch a movie, and so there's a stereotype there. But in terms of someone coming to either of your office, you can't say, oh, the average person, because there is no average person, is there?
I don't think so.
No. It's complicated, and it's not just our offices. They go to their minister, they go to their physician or nurse practitioner. So there are a variety of people they initially approach. Sometimes it can be coming out in things like physical problems, and they don't even recognize that it's related to depression. So there's a variety of pieces that go into this.
But do you start with medication or therapy conversation?
It vacillates depending. A lot of physicians go quickly to medication. Depending on the severity of the depression, if someone's psychotic, is totally withdrawn, and dangerous to themselves, you might think of hospitalization or medication right on. However, sometimes it's helpful to get a course of psychotherapy before you try the medication. One of the studies have actually shown a really excellent cure rate, if you want to use such a word, which we talked about earlier, not fully existing, but combining group therapy, individual therapy, family therapy, child therapy, but also using medication with that. George can talk better than I can about medications with children when you use that.
So when we work with kids, we generally don't want to use medications early. We tend to start with the play therapy first to get a sense of what's going on. Because frequently with children, they're still developing their understanding of how emotions work. And they don't have as many kind of rooted habits that adults do. And so it's easier to make the transitions with just with regular play interventions. In many cases, they do have to go to medication, but it's frequently talk therapy first. Or the equivalent of talk therapy.
Children, question, always individual?
No.
You have group therapy with children?
Yeah, I currently run 5 groups a week.
Really? Mm-hmm. Can you share how a group therapy with children might work?
So group therapy with kids is a little bit different than group therapy with adults.
I think we all have a stereotype image. I don't know if that's accurate of how group therapy of adults might work.
So group therapy with kids consists of, depending on the age group, we tend to do, at least my groups, are a period of time where we introduce ourselves and talk about the things of the week. Then we do, frequently we'll have a social story or some therapeutic content. There's play, where they practice socialization skills. And then we do a wrap-up. That's kind of the way that it works. We'll frequently do some kind of art activity in that process. That's with the younger children. With older kids, we frequently will play games and have art activities that we do. So it's a little bit different because kids don't like to really sit still and just talk. They tend to like to move. So we try and do things that that fit with their developmental age.
Whereas with adults, there are different kinds of groups, certainly. I do what's called open-ended long-term, where people come and they sit in the room and they talk and find some common alliance with other people, find themselves having an opportunity where they can learn from other people and get supported from other people and work on, for instance, their history and other things that come up. Some people have short-term groups or groups that have a particular focus, like compulsive eating, other things like that. So there's a whole range. Some have actually plans, like our new moms group has an educational component to it, too. And so does we have a group for parents that have problematic children starting up soon. And there'll be an educational piece of that. So it varies with different kinds. For us and our practice, you know, George is one of the leaders in our community in group therapy with kids. I do four groups myself for adults. We find them very helpful tools and very supportive tools. And it actually empowers the members of the group because they feel like they're giving something and having some success and contributing to someone else's life, where they don't feel so alone or so different or like such an oddball.
Again, our guests today, Dr. Lewis Weber and Mr. George Enfield, as we talk about mental health and depression. Does religion play a role in this, at least in terms of through therapy? Do you suggest go to church? I mean, that sort of basic attachment to religion with therapy?
No, we don't specifically say go to church. We support the person, whatever they're doing. And church can be very helpful towards people. I was actually interested enough today talking to an ex-priest who talked about getting over his stigmas and difficulties he had because of how he approached his own experience in church. I am very much aware that one of the frontline people are ministers. I mean, they're right on the front lines where these things are going on. Bartenders, interesting enough, were actually taught in a town in Colorado how to identify depressions so they could help people get the help. So there are a lot of frontline people. Your medical people, your clergy, they're very important. Some people include spiritual aspects of life as part of the therapy experience and can be very helpful.
How about, we've talked about kids. Is there a different way for treatment with seniors?
Well, there's some different things that we need to be aware of with seniors. Actually, the amount of depression and suicidal nature and alcoholism is much more severe than people imagine among seniors. You've got several things we're talking about. You're talking about, for instance, loss in the sense of loss of friends and colleagues and from death. You've got the loss of functioning physically and sometimes intellectually, cognitively. You've got that going on. You may see more isolation. The older generation may not be quite as sophisticated in accepting mental illness as, say, the younger people are. Treatment's very similar. Sometimes we see more medication with seniors or people being less likely to come in and see someone. But it's a really prevalent problem amongst our senior population and one of great concern to many of us.
Again, our guests today, Mr. George Enfield and Dr. Lewis Weber, as we talk about depression. Hang tight, folks. Be right back. And welcome back, everybody. Thank you for listening. You can also go to SevillePodcast.com. If you're joining us late, pick up the rest of this program and any of our earlier programs. SevillePodcast.com. Thanks again to our guests, Dr. Louis Weber and Mr. George Enfield, for being here with us today as we talk about depression and mental health. Question for certainly different groups of people struggling with in different situations. Dr. Weber, you talked about someone in of a senior age possibly becoming depressed because of losing friends and losing cognitive ability and maybe some physical function. Do you find those, you know, do you find a larger percentage of people coming to you for assistance, or is that just a greater percentage in the population that you know could possibly or are definitely suffering from depression?
I would like to see more seniors coming in for therapy and more services provided for them. No, you don't. In addition, you've got people that are no longer working, and for them that was a distraction for some people, so they could get away from how depressed they were or what was struggling with. No, I think there's a much bigger need in the senior population than we've really identified, and certainly you don't see a lot of seniors coming in. It's increasing, but it's still, there's more of a stigma. You were talking about stigma earlier. People are more isolated. They may have less motivation to do something. It's a significant problem, one many of us are concerned about.
Mr. Enfield, you've got certainly over the last 10 to 20 years with the push in families, in education, for kids to, you know, take AP classes and, you know, get the 4.0s and go to the best schools. And you talked about the stress that the kids are under. Is the depression in the academic area, is that coming from, and is that the parents identifying that or the kids identifying that?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. And sometimes it's the professional identifying it. Because when you're in the world, it's kind of hard to see it sometimes. So I see a lot of kids that are pushed either by themselves. They push themselves to make these classes because they see their peers doing it, or they feel like that's what they should do, or they want to go to these specific schools and they know that those things are required. In other situations, it's the parents that are pushing. And sometimes it takes someone on the outside to say, is that really necessary at this point? Is that the most important thing? So we do have some of those kinds of pushes, and they come from all angles. I've even had situations where some of the kids are being pushed not by parents or peers, but by grandparents, pushing, saying you need to perform in such a fashion. It does come from all angles.
You've also got recent college graduates who finish with a hefty amount of debt and mm-hmm. are underemployed and talk about stress.
Yeah.
Do you have a significant amount of clients? Is that the proper word there?
Clients or patients?
Clients, patients with that background?
Well, you know, there's something like normalized depression, situational depression, that deal with certain natural stresses you're going through in transitions, you know, transition in age, transition in getting in the work field, leaving the work field. So there's a normality to it. We mentioned earlier before we started the show about, for instance, what happened in Charlottesville this past month.
August 12th.
There are normal reactions that people have that come out as depression that are natural when you go through certain traumas. So it varies. There's a normality too. We're talking about it as a mental illness, but it's also, there's a normality to it. It's when you get stuck and can't go forward that it's time to go in and see someone. Being able to be comfortable with different moods. I think George mentioned in the beginning of the show that there will be changes in moods. And when you go through something like in August, like August 12th, you're expected to go through a period of time where you're feeling depressed, maybe hopeless, discouraged. It's part of the normal progression. And I think sometimes until people are informed that it's normal to be upset about that, it's normal after a significant surgery to have some depression. And until people are aware of that, it kind of calms them down. It's normal for new moms to have difficulties in being a new mom. You know, it's normal to be anxious and down some of the time because you're sleep deprived, for example. So there's a normality piece to it too. You start wondering if someone's not feeling stressed about things like financial problems, which are a big issue. How come they're not? That's normal.
Sometimes one of the things that I find that helps a lot of families to look at is that we have this belief that a trauma is a car accident or an injury that causes us to be in the hospital or a death of a loved one. That's a trauma. All of those are true. Stubbing your toe, however, on the couch when you walk past it is also a trauma. The difference is the volume of that trauma. How loud is it in your body? So, for example, if you stub your toe on the couch and you do it a couple times, you at some point will learn from that trauma to step away from the couch. Leaving school or graduating, that's a trauma. It's a celebration at the same time, which is confusing, but most kids graduate and go through a trauma when they graduate. The, oh my goodness, I've been in school for 12 years. I'm going to be going to college, which is exciting, but I'm losing all of my friends and my family. That's the belief. Not accurate, but it's the belief. That's a trauma. Anytime something impacts our world, loss of a job, loss of high school, loss of college, loss of med school, whatever it is, those are all traumas because the next step isn't predicted. And we're learning from each one of those sorts of things. So we expect this trauma to be a huge event, and it's not always. Sometimes it's a repeated little thing that happens. That's where the traumas can come in as well. So we think about words sometimes, and many people talk about bullies and children getting depressed because they're bullied at school. Those little things like the words, you know, we're calling you, are bad names that we're calling people, or the put-downs, you're not smart, you're stupid. Those kinds of things, each of those are little traumas, but you stack them up, that's where the depression comes in, when it starts to impose themselves, when the traumas put themselves in their place and say, you can't go get out of bed in the morning, or you can't go and have a good time at the movies with your friends. That's when those little traumas turn into depression.
Yeah, there's another piece of it, I think, that there's a misunderstanding, too, about depression. Sometimes think that depression means that you can't work, you can't function, you stay in bed all day, and then if you're working regularly, going to school regularly, obviously you're not depressed, which isn't true. There's a whole continuum. A lot of the people we see are high-functioning people, doing well in many areas. It just comes out in subtle symptoms, sleep problems, eating problems, large weight gains or losses, crying spells, feeling no joy in your life, but they're still highly functional. So that maybe you could use the word stigma if you want. Again, an idea that depression is just for those that are really knocked off their feet, and it's not true. They're very high, as I said, very high functioning people out there that may be yelling at their spouse, maybe easily feeling defeated when they don't do well at something, that are struggling with depression, but you wouldn't necessarily see that in looking at them from the outside.
Again, our guest today, Dr. Lewis Weber, Mr. George Enfield, talking about depression and mental health. How do you get someone who hasn't come to see you, who is suffering from these sorts of symptoms that you've just mentioned, to come see you? Because it doesn't meet the stereotype of being unable to go to work, of just wanting to lay in bed and pull the covers over your head, of not, you know, I am successful, I can go to work every day.
I guess one of the answers is radio shows like this, you know, or things in magazine and newspaper about celebrities going through or people going through it. Recognition of, like with the hurricane problem that's going on, that there will be a level of depression, not just by the people that are in it, but by people that are outside it because of relatives or people that get triggered. Again, because we've done a lot of work with people from August 12th, that's very much in my mind. You know, there are people that weren't down there, that were even distanced from some of the activity going down there, who were very triggered and depressed by it because they had other traumas in their lives or other fears come up, and it builds up and builds up as a result of that. So the art of communicating to people that it's okay to seek out mental health assistance is a constant issue of trying to normalize it. It doesn't make you non-human. It doesn't make you less than someone else in the world. In fact, I frequently mention, we talk about in group therapy, that maybe these are the healthier people that are in therapy. It's the people that aren't prepared to go in or aren't ready to go in or aren't able to really deal with these things that may be in worse shape than those in therapy.
George Enfield, how do you or how have you helped, this is an assumption, the folks from August 12th? I would think that from August 12th you've had some kids
sure
have reacted to August 12th.
Sometimes it's the act of just playing it out. Part of the playroom, part of the play environment is to provide a space that's safe that the kids can explore their experience of things. And so sometimes it's just watching and being supportive when they're acting out these behaviors or acting out these fears. And so we allow them to play out what they see. So I've had multiple children who have played out lots of anger and aggression and frightening events. And then we just talk through that process and try and give them some power in a situation where they feel fairly powerless. Give them a sense of control and understanding. And that tends to alleviate the symptoms. A lot of times the acting out is not being able to express it and being afraid to actually express it. And so they get caught in this loop.
Do you have children who don't want to play with the toys? I mean, is this something that when you first work with them, that it takes some building of trust before they want to do this?
And kids play out. Play is our first form of communication. We start out playing. That's how we develop relationships very early on. That's why a lot of postpartum moms will come into an organization like ours to work with the clinicians, because they're not hearing the cues and they're disappointed. We do have a few kids that don't know how to play. And so part of it is helping them recognize what does it mean to play. And that means that I have to get on the floor and play, which that's what makes my job fun, is I get to play. So there's a few that we have to train, but many of them naturally just come in and they start seeing the materials and start going.
They don't know how to play.
Right.
I'm not sure. I mean, is that because I'm spoiled and always had toys? What is it they don't know how to play?
There's lots of different reasons for kids struggling with knowing how to play. Many times it's because they've spent a lot of times on screens and doing things like just watching the screen, and they aren't actually on the floor playing with toys. Once we get them into it, then it's great. They take off. All the kids learn very quickly.
Again, our guests, Dr. Lewis Weber and Mr. George Enfield, just a few moments left as we talk about depression and mental health. And we should have brought this up much earlier, and I said that I would, but suicide, obviously an issue with depression. Is that something that you have to worry about with kids with the younger age?
Suicide's one of those things when we're working with families of any age that we monitor. Really, really young children, it's less of an issue. But it can be an issue at any age. So we always are monitoring that.
For a long time, they pretended that there weren't suicidal children. It's not in the recent past that they've started to identify that there are children that commit suicide. There are different kinds of being suicidal, too. Sometimes it's just the wish to do away with the emotional or physical pain. It's not really wanting to kill yourself. And sometimes it's a matter of people have made up with their mind and they're going to go forward to it. Sometimes it's a cry for help. There's a whole continuum of being suicidal. Sometimes a reflection of feeling hopeless or unworthy. And it's not that they're going to act on it, but it's like a cry out of how deeply they're hurting and how deeply they're in pain, how much they want to shut it down.
Is it, as with kids, is it, and I guess you really just answered my question, but I would have asked, is it more to save yourself or hurt someone else?
Well, there is that aspect of it, too. You know, the way of expressing anger. And sometimes it comes out in the way it's done, the notes that are left, or making yourself present to someone who's coming in the home when you try suicide as a way perhaps of asking for help or perhaps expressing your anger.
Where can people go to find out more from the two of you? We just have like 30 seconds left, and I want to be people to be able to go and find out more information. There's no way we covered anywhere near enough on the topic.
Well, we're Dr. Lewis Weber and Associates. There's 24 clinicians and two dogs. So we're a full house, but there's a mental health clinic, Region 10. There's your local physician. There's your clergy. There are a number of places you can go to, and a number of private practitioners in our community, University Psychiatry Department, that can be very helpful.
And your website?
It's WeberPsychotherapy.com.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here today. I hope someone will come on in the future, because obviously we just touched on the topic.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. Again, Dr. Lewis Weber and Mr. George Enfield, thank you for listening to the topic. And we'll be back again next week. Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Thanks, everybody.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC-LP Charlottesville.